You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Later this hour, an exploration of the idea of glamour and what it does for us and doesn't do. Glamour is kind of like the manufacturer of our dreams. And as we'll explore this hour, we'll take part in their manufacture. We're complicit in the world of glamour. And it's a much bigger deal, it turns out, than mere glitz. Also, the glamorous stars and galaxies have to give way to the very unglamorous but deep mysteries of dark matter and dark energy. Most of the universe is composed of these two possibly unrelated entities. What we see in the universe is not what we get. A conversation with Neil deGrasse Tyson, who will explain the unexplainable in an amazing new planetarium show that lays out what we don't know rather than explains exactly what we do know about the universe. But first, we begin this hour with what may be a huge development in the war against the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan. On Friday, U.S. fired missiles killed Hakimullah Massoud, the leader of the Pakistani Taliban. The ruthless leader of the most formidable force opposing the Pakistan government also represented the power and authority in one of the major conflicts in the world. Is a conciliator now dead? Here is Massoud in an interview with the BBC just a few weeks ago.
We believe in talks, but the government's taken no serious steps to approach us. The government needs to sit with us. Then we'll present our conditions.
Hakimullah Massoud in a conciliatory tone in that interview with the BBC. Have we lost a conciliator in this strike against the Pakistani Taliban? Madia Tahir is a documentary filmmaker whose film, The Wounds of Waziristan, looks at the impact of drone strikes close to the Afghanistan border. Madia, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what do you think is the significance of this strike and the loss of Massoud in terms of possible peace talks and the U.S.-Pakistan relationship going forward, if it's even possible to calculate?
It's a difficult thing to calculate. Certainly, I think, you know, a lot of people, you know, Hakimullah Massoud was actually quite a vicious leader. So some people have responded to his death with glee, but a lot of people are actually, you know, have expressed a variety of reactions. There are political parties. The Jamaat-e-Islami has called him a martyr. Chaudhry Nassar, the interior minister, has responded fairly, has been, you know, somewhat angry about the death of Hakimullah Massoud because the government was attempting to pursue talks with him and with the TTP. And from his perspective, he says, you know, this was the death of possible peace negotiations.
Is it the authority within the Pakistani Taliban that you really need to speak with to have any chance at peace talks? And will a leadership crisis undoubtedly delay the possibility of that, whatever the reputation of Hakimullah Massoud?
Absolutely. I mean, he was somebody that was sort of had shown himself to be open to peace talks. At least that is what he had said in his last interview. You know, and aside from that, strategically, these talks were important. You know, there could have been various outcomes from these talks. The simplest one would obviously have been that the TTP opens itself up to dialogue. We go through the talks and it's actually able to control the various splinter groups. And, you know, hopefully we have peace. The other option would have been that the groups splinter even more and that there's a breakdown because of the pressure through these talks onto the TTP. Or, you know, the last possibility is that basically that the talks fail and that then the Pakistani government is able to pursue fighting the TTP after having a public that actually understands that negotiations have already been tried and that they had failed. So you know, there were strategic reasons to have these talks, and that plan is now in tatters.
So let's listen once again to Massoud speaking with the BBC just a few weeks ago, talking about the jihadist mission of the Taliban and really talking like a politician. Listen.
Praise be to God. We've targeted those who are with the infidels, America, and we'll continue to do that. But as for the attacks against the property and lives of Muslims, we deny any link to them.
So, Madia, is that a credible argument in terms of the people of Pakistan? Do they believe, in fact, that there's a distinction between the Pakistan Taliban and attacks on Muslims within Pakistan?
You know, I think there people fall on various sides of that. Certainly, the TTP has been responsible for fairly vicious attacks on Pakistanis. So I don't think necessarily that Pakistanis believe that the TTP is not engaged in attacks. However, a lot of these attacks, you know, they've attacked soldiers, they've attacked police officers, and they've also attacked civilians. But I think where it gets muddy is that Pakistanis also see that there's a correlation between the increasing violence of the TTP and the American occupation in Afghanistan and the drone attacks in Pakistan. These things are linked. And I think that's where the anger comes from, that, you know, it is ultimately Pakistanis who are left dealing with the consequences of American actions in Afghanistan and in Pakistan.
Although it would appear that this attack coming really just a few weeks after a meeting between President Barack Obama and the leader of Pakistan, that the civilian leadership in Pakistan and the White House seem to be seeing eye to eye on confronting the Pakistani Taliban, wouldn't you say?
That's hard to say. I mean, today Nawaz Sharif make a public speech, and he said that he was, without sort of mentioning the drone attack, he sort of called for giving peace a chance and giving talks a chance. So I'm not sure that simply because there was, a discussion between President Obama and Nawaz Sharif, that this means, therefore, that they see eye to eye on how to deal with the Pakistani Taliban.
Well, certainly all of these issues disrupted by the events over the weekend. Madia Tahir is a documentary filmmaker. Her film, The Wounds of Waziristan, looks at the impact of drone strikes close to the Afghanistan border. Madia, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
To Washington, D.C. now, and in our continuing quest to understand where Republicans are headed in this Congress, we focus on a possibly futile quest to pass, once again, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA. ENDA would ban workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. It has little hope in the House, but does have some Republican support in the Senate. It's fair to say there will be no left-leaning Republican senator pulling a Ted Cruz filibuster, though, to support the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. But will the Senate outcome be another sign of division within the GOP or a sign that the party may be seeking a new message and a fresh constituency? With us is Sarah Longwell, a senior officer of the Log Cabin Republicans, who have been advocating for equal rights for gays and lesbians within the Republican Party since the 1970s. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, where do you think the ENDA vote stands right now in the Senate? The only real Republican solid votes for, it would appear, are Susan Collins of Maine and Mark Kirk of Illinois.
Yeah, I think we've also got Orrin Hatch and Lisa Murkowski. And I'll tell you this, I think at the end of the day, you're going to see close to 8 Republicans support this, and it's going to pass.
And passing in the Senate when it has virtually no chance in the House, I guess that makes it a safe vote for those senators, but doesn't necessarily represent a movement within the GOP. How do you see it?
Well, I don't know that I would be quite as pessimistic as you are about what's going to happen in the House. I mean, we do have, last whip count, about 30 Republicans who are supporting this. I think there's an opportunity. It is not as strong as in the Senate, where I think it's definitely going to pass. But I'll tell you, when it comes to gay rights and Republicans, I don't think there's ever a safe vote.
And is this an under-the-radar kind of strategy, in the sense that the Congress wants to be perceived as getting something done, and so this may just sort of quietly move forward? Or is this a cause celeb? Is this basically an issue that some Republicans would prefer to rally around on some level?
Well, I think that, you know, with 68% of Americans supporting this legislation and then another 56% of Republicans supporting it, I do think that Republicans are going to try to find a way to come together on an issue like employment non-discrimination, which is an issue where, you know, Chris Christie is a perfect example, where people maybe aren't there on marriage quite yet, but they want to find a way to show people that they're not a bigoted party, that they do want to protect gays and lesbians, that they're not sort of reflexively averse to everything that is viewed as a gay rights issue. And so I think this is the perfect issue for Republicans to find that middle ground. You know, this is a really well-crafted bill in terms of being able to draw Republican support. There's a really strong religious exemption that would allow, you know, Catholic charities, Catholic schools, or other religious institutions or affiliated religious institutions to be exempt from it. And so it really is something that Republicans can find their way to.
Is the outcome in the Senate and possibly the House a symbol of a change of brand, a kind of an embrace of a fresh constituency that was talked about at the Heritage Foundation event, just last month?
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
You think so?
You're absolutely right. There's definitely a shifting of brands here.
But I would think that after what happened with the government shutdown, log cabin Republicans feels a little bit more like, you know, Arctic Circle Republicans. You guys are up there, you know, in an igloo. It's no longer a log cabin. I just wonder where the inclusion piece is here.
Well, I think that, you know, here's what I'll tell you. From on the ground, being sort of doing this as hand-to-hand combat, one of the things we see is we are not getting turned down for meetings. Everybody wants to discuss this. Everyone's welcoming us into their offices to figure out how they could manage to support this. And one of the bigger schisms that we're seeing is not actually between, you know, sort of the hardline conservatives and the moderate conservatives. It's really more with the libertarian wing who doesn't like what they perceive to be sort of these special protections carved out. And so, I think that, you know, the Growth and Opportunity Project the RNC came up with sort of right after the last election, the Republicans are trying to find their way on this. They're trying to find some balance. They're moving in the right direction. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that everyone's there yet. But when you if you come up with eight supporters in the Senate and 30 in the House, I mean, that is a different Republican Party. That's a Republican Party that's moving in the right direction on this.
Is the takeaway that there are some within the GOP trying to find the economic message and pull away from the sort of moral majority values message here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I think there's a lot of support even within the LGBT community for the Republicans' economic message. And I think that Republicans are thinking about this, especially the ones we're talking to in their offices. You know, they're thinking about this from, we want businesses to be strong. We want businesses to have employees that want to stick with them. And so this is a good economic move as opposed to just one that involves sort of the moralism that perhaps, you know, the marriage issue comes with it. And again, 56% of Republicans support this. Just in terms of the most recent poll on it.
Well, so this could be the new glamour issue within the Republican Party as it searches for a brand. Sarah Longwell is a senior officer, treasurer, the executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later in the hour, the notion of glamour through the eyes of some of you beholders out there.
This is Arlene from South Carolina, and my choice for glamorous person would be Meryl Streep, because she possesses just a quiet confidence and an inner beauty and an honesty that just makes her glamorous to me.
I'll go with that. Glamour is personal, but it also has an elusive universal quality. We'll discuss that with Virginia Postrel, author of The Power of Glamour. And keep the conversation going, won't you?
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com.
As you know, in the public radio, public media world, there is a huge industry of science, physics, cosmology, books, movies, radio programs, television series that takes collectively as its mission explaining the cutting edge of science to the non-scientists of the world. And part of the mission is, in fact, to recruit new scientists to gather at the cutting edge and push it out even further. In many ways, the astrophysics world is kind of the holy grail here. Best graphics, most spectacular sense of awe about the nature of our place in the universe. Challenged, perhaps, by the cutting edge science about the brain, although brain graphics can't compete with what our sensors looking at the universe can deliver. So I want to tell you about a scientific presentation show. It's in a planetarium, so it's way beyond IMAX and mere 3D. But what's unique about this show is how little explaining it does. Dark Universe, the latest space show at the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, makes you gasp not with understanding, but with how little we understand about the universe. Neil deGrasse Tyson joins me now. He's the director of the Hayden Planetarium and an astrophysicist himself, our good friend. Neil, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Saw this program, saw this space show, really loved it, and at the end realized that you're all about explaining mysteries or telling people mysteries, not explaining theories that, you know, physicists might learn in college.
Yeah, so that's one of the several elements that distinguish the show. So often you would go to a planetarium show, or as you introduced, there's so much accessible science programming out there, and generally you create a science program when you decide, we know this well enough, it's time to make a show on it. And then you walk away as a viewer saying, I now know more about the universe. We felt we would do an experiment and devote an entire show to two topics about which we know nothing. And one of them is dark matter and the other is dark energy. And collectively, we just call it the dark universe. So that's been – it was a challenge, but I think we rose to that challenge with a great team of writers and –
Timothy Farris, the writer.
Timothy Farris.
Carter Emmert,
a veteran, veteran writer on all things astronomical. Carter Emmert, who's – we have a – we actually at our place have a title – Director of Astrovisualization. And that's the coolest business card you could ever.
Best job in the universe.
Yeah, but a lead curator is Mordecai Mark McClough, a colleague of mine. It's my narration. And we visualize these things we know nothing about using data collected from around the world.
And the stars, the dark strangers of matter and energy, aren't necessarily related. There's not an E equals MC squared relationship between dark matter and dark energy, as far as we know.
If there is, it remains elusive to us. They just simply happen to be two profound areas of ignorance. In fact, the dark matter problem has been with us since the 1930s. It's the longest unsolved problem in modern astrophysics.
Remind us, because, I mean, dark matter and dark energy, physics buffs out there will know that we're not breaking any headlines. We've known about this for a little while. It's the nature of this show that really causes us to have this conversation. But dark matter and dark energy really are, first of all, most of what's in the universe. What we see is not what we get.
Yeah. So the only thing they have in common is that we name them in such a way that they share a word. The word is dark. But since we actually don't know what they are, I joke that we could have just called them Fred and Wilma. We just don't know. And so we shouldn't be too distracted by the names we've given them, because the ideas transcend the word. So 85% of all the gravity in the universe has no known origin. Everything we know and love of material substance in this universe, you add it all up, it is 1/6 of the total gravity available to you. So we don't know. So we call it dark. Well, you really should call it the dark force.
The dark force. Yeah, somebody's taken that one already.
Right, apparently.
But what I love about this show is how, aside from really setting the people in the planetarium in this milieu of the universe universe.
Thanks for remembering and feeling that. That's what distinguishes a planetarium experience from every other media experience you will have, because you are completely immersed. It is in front of you, above you, behind you, to your left and to your right.
But the other really sweet thing here is how you portray the ways, the clever ways, humans have managed to get a slice of this problem and figure out what's going on. The sensors, the little satellites, the odd sort of accidental discoveries that gave us this.
Yeah, for example, in dark energy, which is what we call this mysterious pressure in the vacuum of space that is forcing the universe to accelerate against the wishes of the gravity I just described. So you might say, well, how do you get a handle on that? Well, we get a handle on that through clever sort of backdoor means. What we do is we track supernova, stars that explode and become extremely bright, sometimes rivaling the brightness of their entire galaxy. So bright that we can track them across the universe. And upon doing so, we can then monitor how fast the universe is going, not only nearby, but back in time. Because as you look out in space, you see things not as they are, but as they once were. So you have a timeline down which you are measuring the expansion of the universe. And it's these – and we display for you how we came to these clever ideas. But nonetheless, we can measure dark matter, dark energy. We still don't know what they are.
So galaxies, glamorous, super galaxy clusters.
Love me some galaxies.
Yeah, they're absolutely. So what is dark matter and dark energy? Kind of like the dial tone of the universe, sort of unglamorous?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. We thought that the galaxies were just – what there was. And then we're finding out the galaxies are froth on some other substance, you know, the sea foam, and you can't notice the sea. It's like coming up to a city at night and you just see lights and you say, oh, these are pretty lights. And you don't realize there are whole buildings there and people and infrastructure. That's how blind we've been.
And the discovery of what dark matter and dark energy is certainly the glamorous problem in astrophysics, right?
Yeah, there's probably a half dozen Nobel Prizes ready to roll down the hill into the hands of those who make headway on those two topics.
You think this will come up? You're having a Star Talk Radio live at Town Hall here in New York.
Oh, yeah, tonight. My radio show occasionally does a live performance, if you will. And tonight it's all about gravity. But it's a total celebration of all the things that attract one another in the universe.
And in many ways, the problem of gravity, figuring out what it is, how much there is in the universe, is really the basis for the dark matter, dark energy problem.
Exactly. It's because think about it. We develop a hard-earned understanding of how things work. You trace it back to Isaac Newton. He said, here's your law of gravity. You write it down. That tells us the moon goes around the Earth, Earth goes around the sun. You can calculate that. We're good. We're feeling almost smug about it. And then you go to larger scales in the universe and you find out that that formula does not give you the right answer unless you put in some mysterious force we're calling dark matter. And so the study of the universe is actually as humbling an exercise as humans have ever undertaken.
Well, Dark Universe is at the Hayden Planetarium right now. Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So today, our friends over at the documentary series Retro Report take us back 40 years when the National Cancer Act was signed by then-President Richard Nixon. The act heralded a war on cancer, an idea, a metaphor for fighting a disease that doctors on the front lines resisted almost from the beginning.
This is not a war. We're not aiming at one specific enemy. Cancer is not a single disease like polio. This is many hundreds of diseases. So a silver bullet is a misconception.
That's cancer researcher Dr. James Holland, who was one of those doctors on the front lines 40 years ago and benefited from all the money that started to flow as Americans joined this new battle on cancer.
The amount of money that's being spent for medical research is, well, it's just piddling. You won't believe this. Less is spent on cancer research than we spend on chewing gum.
In many ways, this war idea was the inspiration of philanthropist Mary Lasker. You heard her there speaking in the late 60s, early 70s. She led the fight for passage of the National Cancer Act. She succeeded in raising awareness, but eradicating cancer, that goal eludes us. Retro Report producer Jill Rosenbaum joins us now. Welcome to the program, Jill.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, war on cancer, good fight, bad metaphor, or have we created a monster with the war on cancer and all that it produced? What was your inspiration for looking back?
Well, I had an interest in medical and science coverage for a long time, and it interested me that we had been fighting cancer for such a long time and, in fact, hadn't made the kind of progress that had been promised or that had been anticipated. And it just seemed to, you know, something to take a look at. Scientists hate this war metaphor. And they, as Dr. Holland said in that clip that you played, you know, they don't want people to think that cancer is just one disease that can be eliminated with one discovery. And, you know, in the 1940s, we really saw the widespread use of antibiotics, which was radical. I mean, it transformed medical care. People survived infections that they had died from in the past. We saw polio be cured. And so I think people did have this idea that you could just take on cancer in the same way. And obviously, that's not true.
In some ways, the raised awareness has also raised people's vigilance, increased the amount of testing, increased the amount of false positives. But there has been progress in fighting certain kinds of cancer, yes?
Well, there has certainly been progress in fighting early stages of cancer. So, you know, people who have tumors that haven't spread beyond the original organ of origin, we've done quite well with them. We're doing really well with some of the blood cancers, some of the leukemias and lymphomas, testicular cancer. But the truth is that for most forms of cancer, once it metastasizes, which means, you know, spreads to other parts of the body, we still really don't know how to cure most of those cancers. And I think that is disappointing to a lot of people. The progress, interesting to me, is in lifestyle change. And just seeing the impact people quitting smoking has had is pretty inspiring.
And the behavior changes are really part of the raised awareness. People understand that cancer is not something that simply lands. It is the result of choices sometimes.
Yes, and I think we need to point out that public health officials are very worried about the impact the rising obesity levels could have on cancer rates, because there does seem to be a correlation between deaths from certain cancers and obesity. So just as quitting smoking helps prevent cancer, it could be that increased obesity causes cancer.
Retro Report producer Jill Rosenbaum taking us back 40 years to when the National Cancer Act was signed by President Richard Nixon. Jill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
One very serious legacy of the Nazi regime in Germany is the unaccounted-for art looted and hidden away, stolen from the collections of people killed or scattered in the Holocaust. The art scattered far from home, some recovered, some not, 16,000 looted pieces in all. And now we learn that 1,500 pieces worth perhaps $1 billion was found in Germany in the hands of a collector in Munich. The art was actually discovered 2 years ago, but the scale of the find and its astounding location right in Germany were only made public over the weekend. With us is Jonathan Petropoulos, John V. Kruhl, Professor of European History at Claremont McKenna College. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Hello, I'm glad to be with you.
How important is this find, and how astounded are you that it was in Munich?
It's an extraordinarily important find, perhaps even unprecedented. I think all of us are surprised to find these 1,500 artworks now over 60 years after the end of the war. That it is in Munich is not so surprising to me. Munich was a center of the art trade during the Third Reich, and then a center for a network of old Nazi art dealers after the war. And so if it was going to be anywhere in Germany, in my opinion, it would most likely be in Munich.
What was the commerce in these 1,500 pieces? Was it being quietly collected by someone who just wanted to own them, or was it being resold, this collection, to places around the world?
Well, it's really an extraordinary story. The 1,500 artworks, as best we know right now, and the news of these artworks broke this weekend in Europe, and we're still trying to learn more about exactly what these paintings are and where they came from. But apparently 300 of them were from German state collections. They were purged in 1937, 1938 by the Nazis as part of their so-called degenerate art action. And the paintings, the artworks, were given to four different art dealers, and one of them is the person who acquired these works. His name is Hildebrand Gurlitt, and he's a especially interesting figure because he was Jewish, according to Nazi racial laws, yet he collaborated, if you will, with the Nazis. And so 300 are from the German state collections museums. 1,200, we think, were looted from German and other European Jews. And Gurlitt not only helped the Nazis liquidate these works from the state collections, but he was an art agent for Hitler as Hitler created his Führer Museum. And Gurlitt traveled throughout Europe and had special dispensation. And he evidently bought many of these works from Jews under duress and from middlemen. And so we believe that many of these works are stolen assets from European Jews. And so what happened at war's end, Gurlitt was in Dresden, and as we all know, Dresden was bombed by the Americans and the British. And after the war, Gurlitt told the American authorities that all his art and all his papers were destroyed. He lost everything.
Wow.
And he went through denazification, but because he was Jewish, because he had been a proponent of modernism, he'd always been a great advocate for artists like Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, Kirshner and Franz Marc and Max Beckmann, whose works are represented in this hoard, they let him off and he went back into the art trade. And he died in a car crash in 1956, unexpectedly. And so his son moved in or took over the collection. And that's the person who we're dealing with now. His name is Cornelius Gurlitt. And he's about 80 years old. And he was a really an extraordinary, eccentric character. Cornelius Gurlitt lived completely off the grid in Germany.
Wow.
He didn't register with the police, which you're obliged to do by German law. He didn't pay taxes. He didn't collect a pension. He evidently just lived by selling off these artworks one by one.
Unbelievable. The collection and the sale is really a story, an untold story of World War II and the Holocaust. Remind us of some of the artists who are in this collection before we go. Picasso, Chagall, Matisse, among others.
Exactly. And we're just learning today from European sources that there are some old masters mixed into the group as well. There's a Durer, there's some other paintings too from Dresden. But you know, it's being valued at over $1 billion, and it's a truly sensational find. One thing that's just
actually, we're going to have to leave it there, Jonathan, but your enthusiasm is infectious. Jonathan Petropoulos, John V. Kroll Professor of European History at Claremont McKenna College, on a $1 billion find of looted art objects from Nazi Germany. In a moment, the glamour of cool and the coolness of glamour. I should disclose that my 12-year-old daughter told me over the weekend that I'm now too old to say the word cool. So there you go, my formerly cool life passing before my eyes. But first, is smoking still cool, or is it completely uncool? So uncool right now, in fact, that New York City, one of the capitals of global coolness, can ban smoking for anyone under the age of 21 and make that ban stick. The question for us today, though, is do bans drive the public health mission of reducing smoking, or are bans a lagging indicator, really more of a sign that smoking is already on the way out on some level? Back in the 1950s, 45% of Americans reported that they smoked. 32% in the 1980s, down to 19% in 2011. Jody Sindelar is a health economist and professor at the Yale School of Public Health. She also is a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. She uses behavioral economics to study addiction. Jody, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So this is kind of a cart and horse discussion. Do you think the decline in smoking is the reason why this ban works, or do bans actually contribute to the momentum to push people away from this addiction?
Well, I think you're right that the social norms allow this kind of law to be considered and then passed. But actually, I think it'll be quite effective because most people start smoking under the age of 18, and 99% have started smoking by age 25. So if you don't allow the option of smoking, if people can't purchase cigarettes, or actually stores can't sell cigarettes, I think it will stop youths from starting.
So you're basically intervening in that cool to purchase moment where you see something cool maybe in popular culture, and you're actually not permitted to act on that impulse, even though it seems glamorous, and that stops the cycle right at the beginning.
Right, and not only it stops it for you, it stops it for your friends, so there's no social pressure to be cool if your friends can't be cool either.
And it's not as though it makes smoking uncool to have it banned, it's just too much trouble. You can sort of see people smoking in the movie, but you realize, you know, if we're going to actually go out and do that, it would just be too much of a problem. And so it kind of shuts it down before it gets started.
Yes. And if you don't start by when you're young, you never start, because people are smarter than that. They know that it's going to be harmful to their health. And when they're young, they always think they can stop whenever they want. They don't realize it's addictive. And then later they find they can't stop because of the nicotine.
Based on your research, do you expect to get below 19%, or are we reaching a sort of bottom floor figure beyond which we're really not going to go in terms of the percentage of people smoking in the United States?
Well, actually, New York City has done a good job of reducing it below the 19% for youth and everyone, because some important changes were increasing the price. The price of cigarettes in New York can be $14.50, which is really prohibitive. If you smoke one pack a day at that price, you're spending about $5,300 on smoking, which is a prohibitive expense.
What do you make, Jody Sindelar, of the efforts that electronic cigarette manufacturers have made to try to glamorize the use of their products, claiming that they're safer? But really, it seems as though the bigger message is you can be just as cool smoking one of these electronic cigarettes as you ever could doing what Bogey and, Bacall did back in the movies.
Well, the e-cigarettes have brought up a lot of controversy, not only in the United States, but worldwide. Governments are trying to decide whether to ban them or regulate them as medical devices. And the reason is that e-cigarette smoking, you actually only get nicotine. You don't get much of the tar and the toxins that hurt you. So if that, to the extent that's true, you can be addicted but not harming yourself, which is a lot better than tobacco. And it can help people quit. On the bad side, it can normalize smoking back to, well, this is a fine thing to do, and it may spread over to tobacco, thinking that you can normalize tobacco. Also, because it comes in flavors like black chocolate cherry, it can attract youth to smoking, and then again, it may generalize to them using tobacco cigarettes as well. So it's very controversial.
And something you're likely to study in the future over there at Yale, at the Yale School of Public Health. Let me ask you a question about why cigarettes are a special case, and tobacco seems to be a special case, because in New York they tried to enact a ban on large sugar drinks, and the courts ruled against it. There was a huge public outcry against it. It's not an addiction per se, but there does seem to be a difficulty in enacting these kinds of bans in other areas of behavior.
Well, one thing that has been difficult for tobacco in the past is just a long history where advocates kept trying and trying and trying. So if you talk to me 40 years ago, you'd say, oh, it's really hard to get anything passed in tobacco. So it may be just a matter of time. Even Mexico right now, that's one of the biggest consumers of soda, they're now trying to pass some of these taxes and bans and things like that. So it just may be a matter of time. But tobacco is different because in the sense that it's so clearly harmful. I mean, there's no doubt that it just hurts every organ of your body, particularly your heart and your lungs and cancer. And if you don't start when you're young, you're not going to start. So there's a good opportunity to start prevent people from ever starting.
Finally, would you say that based on your research that the fighting of addiction on any level is a top-down sort of government-directed effort, or is it more of a bottom-up sort of community and prevention directive?
Well, it has to be both, but we've had some really big successes on policies. For example, as I said, taxing cigarettes to raise the price, not only does it stop people from smoking or prevent them from smoking, it also raises revenue, so it's very popular. And smoking bans in restaurants, workplaces, schools has also been very effective, and that's both free to the government and also affects the peers and yourself. So it has a very effective and wide impact. But at the same time, people have to quit smoking on their own as well.
Indeed. Jody Sindelar is a health economist and professor at the Yale School of Public Health, trying to interrupt the sort of glamour impulse and image of smoking and the public health message of trying to control people's addiction. She's a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Jody, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Are you ready? Are you ready?
So just how glamorous do you feel?
Anybody get a med?
The glamour of Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart smoking away on the Hollywood screen, making us all dream of just being them. Are they it? Or do Bogey and Bacall just move over for Kanye and Kardashian what's-her-name?
When the paparazzi surround you, you know, why would you be with this person? And I'm saying I'm being with this person because, you know, I love this person.
Glamour is, of course, in the eye of the beholder. It causes us to do things or buy things or dream things we can never be. But that's okay. Because we get a tiny bit of stardust if we just follow the royals, the Brad Pitt Angelinas, looking the part is the part. That's the magic and superficiality of glamour and the skill of pulling it off.
I'm Shannon. I'm in Locust Grove, Oklahoma. Most glamorous woman in my life was my grandmother, Joy. She would rock gold lame as beautifully fresh-colored beehive and penciled-in eyebrows in Podunk, Oklahoma. She eventually was the lunch lady at the schools, still rocking that lame till the day she passed away. I miss you.
Rocking the gold lame. Thank you, Shannon, for that story. What's your sense, personal sense of glamour in your own life at 877-8-MY-TAKE? Tell us a story or post a comment thetakeaway.org. With us, she's written about branding and glamour and taught glamour at the School of Visual Arts here in New York. Virginia Postrel is the author of The Power of Glamour, her new book. Virginia, welcome.
Thank you.
There's so much here. There's so many pictures and references that are so great. How personal is the idea of glamour and how universal is the idea of glamour?
That's a great question because it is both. My take on glamour when I sort of delved into it and tried to figure out what is it, is that it's a phenomenon like humor in the sense that it is probably universal. It is something where there's an audience and there's something, an object, a person, something glamorous, and you have an interaction between that audience and that glamorous thing, and in that interaction, an emotion arises. So just as you have something funny and an audience, and the audience either finds it funny or not and laughs, there's an audience and there's this glamorous object, and you feel this pang of if only, this sense of longing and projection. And what is glamorous to you depends on who you individually are, and it also depends on the cultural, the culture that surrounds you. What is significant in that culture? What is meaningful?
And Marilyn Monroe can be considered glamorous by people who aspire to be her, and by people who are repulsed by her. It both confirms the idea of glamour.
Well, I tend to think of glamour as being more about the drawing you in. So, yes, you can objectively say she is glamorous to other people but not to me. But to say that she's glamorous to yourself means that you somehow want to be in the world she represents.
Aspirational.
So for example, I very much as an analyst say in 2008 – Barack Obama was a very glamorous candidate.
All right, here we go. This is Barack Obama, glamour.
Yes, we can.
And Bill Clinton, would he be considered glamour?
No, I would not consider Bill Clinton glamorous. Bill Clinton, however, was highly charismatic. All successful politicians are somewhat charismatic. But Bill Clinton was kind of over-the-top charismatic.
Well, let's hear Clinton.
It's fine for people in rich countries to say this is what it ought to be. They don't have to live in these little villages and watch people die like flies.
So you can relate to Clinton, but you don't necessarily want to be him. But Barack Obama has a heroism that you do aspire to.
Well, Barack Obama in 2008, because once you get to be president for a long time, a lot of the mystery disappears.
Boy, isn't
but
the
Barack
truth.
Obama in 2008 as a candidate really encouraged, maybe not intentionally, but his supporters projected onto him all their longings for what they wanted in a country, what they wanted in a president. And he was somewhat mysterious. He didn't have a long history in public affairs. He was from this slightly exotic but not too exotic background, which is another thing. You need that mystery, but it can't be opaque.
Well, there's something about the presidency also that destroys the whole idea of glamour, as you write in here, that it's about the toss-off. It's about the effortlessness, the Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire. They do it practically asleep, dancing there on screen. And you don't do anything in your sleep if you've been president for a term and a half.
Right. Glamour is an illusion. The word originally meant a literal magic spell. And what the illusion is this grace. And I have a chapter in The Power of Glamour, specifically about grace, this effortlessness, hiding all the difficulties. I mean, one thing, going back to Obama in 2008, one thing that he encouraged people to believe is that sort of politics would magically vanish and all the political conflicts.
Yeah, he was right about that. You know, I want to give a sense of the list of differences that you talk about here. Che Guevara, of course, glamorous. Castro, just charismatic. Thomas Jefferson, glamorous. Andrew Jackson, just charismatic.
There's no just about charismatic.
Well, I guess. I'd be happy to have either one, I suppose. I love this one. Here is glamour in your view.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the streets. Though back at the time,
Tupac Shakur. The late Tupac Shakur.
It helps to die, by the way.
It helps to die, in a sense, the power of glamour. All right. Is this just highbrow, lowbrow? Because here's the contrast.
One, two,
Bring it to the folks. Snoop Doggy Dogg and Dr. Dre is at the dope.
Snoop's charisma by your formula.
Yeah, I think Snoop has this kind of stage presence. I mean, you know, you can't not look at him. And it's not about being mysterious. It's about a different kind of presence. And charisma is this personal quality. It's not about the audience. The audience responds to it, but it's something like intelligence. And the other thing is, like you mentioned, Andrew Jackson, when a person dies, their charisma goes away. Whereas when a person dies,
their glamour
is often intensified.
That's so interesting. Respond to what one of our listeners said, and that is, it's impossible to have glamour these days where we know everything about everybody. There's nothing that's effortless, and the media makes everyone share constantly.
Well, I think that one of the amazing things about glamour is that anything is glamorous because it cuts against a lot of our deeply held values like honesty and transparency and frankness and comfort and overt sexuality, all of these things. That said, I think we exaggerate how universal this full disclosure is. And there are movie stars or actors, to take a traditionally glamorous category, who are glamorous. I heard an earlier listener mention
Meryl Streep. Who to you is the most glamorous before we go?
Well, I think Kerry Washington is having a very glamorous moment, which is interesting for a TV star. It's unusual.
Virginia Pastorello is the author of The Power of Glamour. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So who's the most glamorous person you've ever known? What makes them so glam?
My friend Jill Sockwell is the most glamorous person I know. She always looks great, even when she's picking up her two girls from school. She just finds a way to bring pizzazz into every aspect of her life. It's really inspiring to be around her. And, of course, I hope a little of that glamour rubs off on me.
Wouldn't you like to meet Jill Sockwell? Thanks so much for sharing. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com, the Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments across the country.